Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and Dialect is Bristol's first podcast set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon on BCFM 93.2 at 2 p.m. Miscarriages of justice are growing in Britain, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite website and editor Sabine McNeil. Plus, our weekly news and Disabled People's Update with Jason Yannakopoulos. And also Peruvian-born genius documentary maker Alan Frankovich this week. Sorry, carried over from last week, which we didn't have time for it. He died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall back in 1997, documenting black operations under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So straight in this week, saying hello to Sabine McNeil. Hello, Sabine. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you. Welcome to you, Tony.
Thank you. Now, this week we're going to talk about the Holly Gregg case. This is a particular, what we believe to be a miscarriage of justice. And I mean, I think I'll start by asking Sabine, when something hasn't actually even come to court, it's very difficult to call it a miscarriage of justice. And the miscarriage of justice can possibly start because a case hasn't even come to court in the first place.
That's a very good point. I mean, miscarriages of justice is when it's already too late. What happens until then and before that in terms of cover-up is what I have certainly observed over and over again. And something really tragic is that, just as an attitude, instead of people admitting, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, they cover up and make things worse and are not afraid of committing one crime after another in the process. And that's what's been happening with Holly as well, I'm afraid. I'm not an expert on Holly's case at all, but I have been to court when she and her mother were in the Royal Courts of Justice. And I know Belinda McKenzie very well, who's the spokesperson for the campaign. And it seems to me that it's just, if you like, the worst of all child or abuse or sexual abuse cases, and it's a very particularly interesting in quotes, because Holly has Down syndrome, and as a particular characteristic, she happens to have a very good memory, and therefore she remembers the names of all of her 22 abusers.
The trouble, of course, is that this still hasn't been tested in court. I mean, surely you would think that if there are these accusations flying around, that they should be tested in some way. And then we know, at the end of the day, that, I mean, it may be harrowing. It obviously is for people who have been abused or in any way victims of crime to varying degrees to actually go to court and testify. But how come this case still hasn't come to court?
Well, I don't know the details, and there is a court hearing coming up in Shropshire some in the near future, but there have been various cases, and above all, in terms of proof or evidence, the police have a record of her internal scars. So, the evidence is there, the proof is there, but the people who are the abusers have so much to lose that they need to cover up.
Now, give us what are the accusations that have been made in this particular case? As you say, Holly, H-O-L-L-I-E, not H-O-L-L-Y, Holly Gregg, G-R-E-I-G is the name, yes. And there's a website, Holly Demands Justice. What evidence is there of the abuse of Holly?
Well, that's what it has said, they're internal scars. But in a way, the abuse is then in the persecution of everybody who helps or who wants to help or who tries to bring justice to this terrible abuse. I mean, the worst is that her uncle was actually murdered. And there is, I mean, it's, well, of course, it's made to look to be suicide. And Robert Greene, who is the hero who tried to bring justice to her story, he had to go to prison.
No, I know he actually tried to stand in the general election a couple of years ago, didn't he?
Yes.
On this particular issue as a candidate, I think in Scotland somewhere.
Yes. Yes, the whole case is in Scotland. And for anybody who has studies paedophilia and the next worst thing, which is Satanism, apparently Scotland is sort of part of the system in a bad way, and it's, in a way, it's just too much and too hard and too tough to believe, and you don't want to know about it, and yet it's true, Tony.
Well, the trouble is impossible to tell, but I mean, you've said that some people are seeing this as a sort of almost like a litmus test, the Holly Gregg case, where if people aren't prepared to consider it as a possible miscarriage of justice, that they may be dodgy or dangerous in some way.
Well, that is what is very, very interesting indeed. In fact, when I got attacked on Victims Unite, I kind of had to learn from the Holly Demands Justice site how to cope with such negative influences and people. I learned that that there are names for these people, haters and trolls and shills. And I just ask myself, why is it that it is necessary to create misinformation, disinformation, and ultimately to create, if you like, another kind of a spin on the whole story. And that's what is happening. Fortunately, I know a lady who's very, very sharp in analyzing websites, and she kind of smells whether sites are mis- and disinformation sites, and she has put two videos together where she puts her criteria together as well. And that to me was quite an eye-opener, and that helped. And it's rather significant, I think, that it's this Holly Gregg campaign that has definitely been the highest profile campaign of any kind of child abuse. It's not child snatching, but it's child abuse. And of course that's what interests me, the connection between the child snatching and the purpose, if you like, whether it's paedophilia or money. But anyway, I'd keep jumping from one thing to another.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about that case, if I can call it that, maybe that's not the right word to use, but because Holly is a Down syndrome child, the idea being that she wouldn't be in any way a decent witness in court, but that isn't necessarily the case, is it, for Down syndrome people?
No, this is the interesting aspect. She has been accepted as a perfectly valid witness, and I find it particularly remarkable. I guess not everybody knows, and it may not apply to all Down syndrome people either, that they may or may not have this exceptional memory. But then the other problem was that she was also, in the kind of a typical way, as many, 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 or most victims who are continually being abused by the same people, they are being groomed, and they are always promised something or threatened something, and in her case she was threatened to, if she was to say anything to her mother, her dog would be killed.
Now the other thing about that case is that there are very what we would call high level people accused. I mean, I think even some police and people involved in the judiciary.
Yes, and I was quite shocked, also women and social workers and doctors, and it's quite horrendous. And they have begun to organize these mis- and disinformation sites. And I guess that's just what people need to do and have to do. And they use the media, the mainstream media, but they need to use the web now as well to confuse the people who don't know enough about the case, who don't quite know how to make up their mind, who don't quite know what to believe and why. And because it's also so difficult to believe, Tony. It's so terrible. You don't want to believe that.
Yeah, there's a big psychological factor here, isn't there? As in many of the cases you look at, Sabine, where you know people recoil away from the entire story because they think, how could anybody behave like that?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I must say, I know I have 12 child snatching cases really under my fingertips. I really know them well, but I've come across lots of them. And victims similarly, whether it's bankruptcies and home repossessions. And there is no doubt about it that victims are their own worst enemy because they suffer from this legal abuse syndrome and they don't know how to behave, if you like, in a normal, undamaged fashion. I mean, it's just clear you are wounded as a victim. And the best that you can do is become a survivor, as especially of sexual abuse, and then eventually possibly a starfighter, campaigner, and advocate to become a bit of a sane contributor, realizing that you're not alone, that you're one of a major pattern of abuse and of institutionalized abuse, I'm afraid.
That takes a lot of courage.
Yes, well, my mum used to say that about me. My daughter has no fear. I can't help it. Maybe it's because I survived the bombing of Dresden where I didn't scream, apparently. Maybe I was so shell-shocked that nothing can frighten me anymore, Tony.
Okay, what you were talking about, people on the internet, harassment and aggressive behaviour by anonymous screen names, people that you never meet. That's another fascinating side of this. I mean, I come across this quite a lot as well. I don't know, I'm going to offer my point of view on this and see what you think, which is when people are particularly personal, rude and aggressive, that's a pretty good indicator that they're not necessarily there to contribute to the debate.
I would think that that's true, especially under anonymous names. I mean, I try to understand the kind of psychology as well, because I have a lot of psychological experience, because doctors told me that my pain was psychological, so I had to study psychology and find out. And the need to be heard is always very, very big. Most children haven't been heard enough by their parents. Most victims have not been heard enough and certainly in general not by their perpetrators. And there are often therapeutic approaches where one tries to bring the two together. And therefore, victims want and need publicity, 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 as if that's going to make a difference. But of course, the interesting thing is it may very well do. And this is what I find so challenging now, since mainstream media tend not to listen to these victim stories. The web does. And people who haven't been heard as a child, as an adult, and suddenly they can just type anything anywhere, and it may just be therapeutic for them to be negative, and they don't realize that they don't contribute.
Now, what you mentioned there about the media, I know Newsnight Scotland actually filmed a documentary, a piece for Newsnight Scotland, all about the Holly Gregg case, and then the people who participated in that piece on Newsnight Scotland were called a few days before it was due to go out and say, well, we're very sorry it's been cancelled, which is a really harrowing thing. If anyone has been bearing their soul in front of a TV camera with the promise that it's going to be going out on national television, to be then told, well, actually, now it's not. Now, this reminds me a little bit of Liz McKean at Newsnight, the London Newsnight, interviewing some of the victims of Jimmy Savile, only to be told by her editor that they were going to spike it and that this wasn't going to run on Newsnight right across the country because of the Jimmy Savile tribute that was going out that Christmas. This is Christmas before last. I mean, how do we know whether to trust, you know, the mainstream press when they were to contact us and say, well, we're interested in your story, you may end up doing an interview, baring your soul, telling people about the most intimate details of your life for then nothing to be aired.
Well, that's exactly shocking, isn't it? I mean, I certainly was aware of that aspect of the Holly Gregg campaign too, and I was in the Frontline Club to hear a debate about the Newsflash story in the Jimmy Savile context. And in the end, Tony, I can always only explain it by the rule of money. People are employed, they risk their jobs, and of course it's more important to follow the people who tell them what to do.
I suppose with the editor of Newsnight, Peter Rippon, I mean, we can look at him in the Jimmy Savile case particularly as being responsible for the decision to stop the Jimmy Savile interview Liz McKean had done going out. But the main thing is he has bosses and his bosses have bosses. So there's this sort of invisible layer of management at the top of the mainstream press that nobody really knows who they are or what they do. I mean, what I suppose I'm coming to is, you know, what advice would you give to people who do feel that they're a victim of a miscarriage of justice or other crime of some sort, who want to actually contact, at least let people know, and be part of a wider network?
Well, quite frankly, by now, I think the mainstream media are not helpful, and therefore the only thing is for people to either start their own blog or at least spread the news via or spread their story via the existing blogs and sites. And that's where the challenge begins. Victims can in general not kind of tell their story in a concise and journalistic way, and that's where I came in. I kind of helped them to formulate the who, why, where, what, when questions, and to put years of suffering and on different levels of different institutions and different attempts to get heard, to get some kind of justice, to get that kind of condensed. And what I find really interesting is that most people are not after compensation. They are just for justice, the sense of injustice they have experienced. That's what is so hurtful. That's what is so painful. That is so hard to make sense of, I believe. It just makes you mad. You cannot believe it. You are told black, but then it's white, and the other way around. And I think it's that it's the irritating thing. And I wish I knew who pulls the strings in terms of mainstream media. Who decides what is topical and what is not topical? Who decides what is allowed to be reported and what is not to be reported when it first gets commissioned and then gets pulled? I don't know, but I think what is sort of to be suspected is that the pedophile rings get very, very high and hard and are up in the hierarchy and cover all layers and levels, and the mainstream media are just part of it.
Well, it almost paints a picture of a kind of, you know, criminalised establishment, an establishment that feels that maybe it's on the ropes, that much of civil society doesn't trust it anymore, and that they're kind of closing ranks in a way. Is that something? Yeah. Is that exaggerating?
Yeah. No, I think I would concur with that, Tony, as sad as it may sound, and that's why it is really important for people to wake up to it and to realise it. I mean, there is an article in The Guardian today about an American software company, a defence company, that has produced software to stalk, if you like, people on social media now. I mean, my conclusion is we have created a situation of states in general, the state versus its people anywhere.
Well, that's a very much a kind of Big Brother scenario. But the other angle to all this, of course, is where we're living in times right across the Western world, particularly, that are not looking good financially and economically. We've got a Spanish guest on in a minute who will be talking about the situation right now in Spain with the economics, because certainly we in Britain are looking at Spain and worrying, maybe biting our fingernails, thinking, well, you know, in a couple of years' time, maybe even less, we could be where Spain is at. Can you just give us a bit of insight into you know, how to fix our economy, because everyone is aware that it's wrong, it's not working, debt is growing at massive rates. If you were sitting in the shoes of the chairman of the European Central Bank, which is be lovely to think you that was possible, Sabine, but you know, if you were, what kind of directives would you be issuing? What would you be saying should be done to sort out the financial mess we're in?
Well, that's very interesting that you asked me that question, because I was in the House of Lords in a select committee where Monsieur Trichet, the then president or boss of the European Central Bank, was asked, what about accountability? And that's the key. They are not accountable to anybody. He just said, well, we invite the finance ministers once a year and they don't show up. And so if I was the boss in Frankfurt, I would certainly apply my mathematical wisdom and know about the difference of each of the national economies. I mean, you just cannot make the euro work in the same way in each of the countries. And of course, in my Big Brother perspective, I would like to believe that it was purposely done that way. And so to counteract, the European president isn't in favor of the people. He doesn't want to make something happen that works for the people. So if I was there, I want to make something happen for the people, interest-free money needs to be put into circulation. That is the key. This whole madness of usury, of making money out of money and bringing always only interest-bearing credit into circulation and never interest-free cash, that is at the heart of the problem. And instead of getting in governments into more and more debt, governments should issue interest-free, their interest-free version of their euro. On coins, on the coin and on the note, you can see that national difference, but the money supply has to be on a nationwide level, not on the Europe-wide level.
Sabine, your website is, as we say every week, www.victims-unite.net. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
Brothers and Harvest for the World. Now to an equally interesting item, at least I think it's interesting anyway, which is we're just talking with Sabine McNeil there from Victims Unite website about the economy, and she was saying how she'd fix it if she was one of the people in power. Actually, I think, you know, maybe, hopefully, if you know anyone in power, get Sabine's McNeil's idea and tell them we need to have interest-free money. Because, of course, without interest, we don't have all this debt and we have to pay the debt off. But anyway, we're very lucky to be joined today by a journalism student from Spain, Julia Inza. Now, did I pronounce that right, Julia? I probably didn't, did I?
Julia Inza.
Is that okay? Yes. Inza. So your Prime Minister now, who is he? Remind me of his name.
Mariano Rajoy.
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 Yes. I mean, on our programme I do Friday Drive Time last week, we were discussing how he's been a bit of a naughty boy, hasn't he? Tell us a little bit about him.
He has been accused of illegally...
See, you're getting your English lesson right live, aren't you?
of illegally collecting money. Illegal.
Oh, dear. Yes. So he's letting the side down, isn't he, really? He's letting us all down, letting the Spanish people down, really, by being a bit of a crook himself, maybe. I mean, I think we've had, you know, we have similar questions here about our leaders. Anyway, what else do you want to tell us about what's going on in Spain?
I'm going to talk about the situation in Spain. It's very bad. Since I come to Bristol, I have been listening very bad news from Spain. And the main problem is unemployment. It's more than 27% of people don't work. And it's becoming more difficult to find a job. But economic analysts say that this situation won't improve until 2015. For this reason, many young people are traveling to other countries like UK, Germany or Switzerland to search of a better future. But that's not all. In recent weeks, the Prime Minister, Rajoy, has been accused of illegally collecting money. Now, Spanish Million expect his resignation. So every day, the streets are filled with protesters who shout urgent things.
Who shout?
Shout.
Urgent?
Urgent.
Things. Okay, yes. So the people are really coming out onto the streets demanding change.
Yes.
Because the Prime Minister, why doesn't he resign?
I don't know.
He doesn't want to admit that he's done something wrong.
I don't know.
Well, it's a pity, isn't it? I mean, these leaders, they're not very good, are they? Not really very good.
No.
But you yourself, you see, you're here in Bristol, learning English. You have also gone abroad to try and, you know, maybe get some work and also to increase your skills so you have more chance of getting work. Tell us about some of the other countries you've been to.
For holidays.
Okay, so where have you been for holidays then?
Last year I have been in London and in Rome, in Italy.
Yes, but it sounds quite nice, Rome. Is it nice to visit? I don't think I've ever been there.
It's very beautiful, Rome.
Yeah?
Yes, and 2 years ago I went to New York with my parents, and 5 years ago I went to Switzerland with my friends.
Okay.
For holidays.
I mean, this might be a bit of a difficult question, but if you were in charge of your country, what would you do? If you were in charge of your country, what would you like to see happen in Spain?
Change the situation, because is now the government is very bad for me, and young people, many people don't find a job, and a crazy situation. The people die. Poor, very poor, yeah.
Very poor, yeah. Okay. All right, well, Julia Inza, it's a bit of a sad tale, but at least there are some people who are doing something about it, which is what you're doing. So thanks very much for joining us on Dialect today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. The Maltese Double Cross was never repeated, but can be watched online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the United States CIA to blow up the Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 21st of December 1988. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. That series documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Bader-Meinhof, and even the IRA. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Alongside the feature films of the Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of the Western intelligence agencies, such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence. All these secret political operations were deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo. So here he is, delayed from last week.
I'll predict that in the using the justification of fighting terrorism, and in some instances they are going to be encouraging and publicizing terrorist incidents in order to get everyone nervous, you're going to see them start doing things inside this country to control people they've been preparing to do for a period of time. In other words,
why?
Well, they have the right now, for instance, to infiltrate any kind of political organization, any kind of group at all in this country, which is what they were not allowed to do before, partly because of the contradictions and the problems of jurisdiction between the FBI and the CIA. That is really, they can do it on the flimsiest of excuses.
And if somebody who is a member of one of these organizations says, hey, I think that guy's a CIA, they can put him in jail for 5 years.
Exactly. Exactly, because they've just passed this law making it a felony to name the CIA people. And that's not going to stop, for instance, foreign newspapers from naming the names of CIA people. It is going to make it very difficult and intimidating for any American press. And as I said, the reason the CIA exists is not to keep these covert operations secret from the countries that are being targeted, the Nicaraguans, who are having their own people killed every week, know the CIA is behind these things. We don't, though. We read the things and say, oh, it's just another one of those accusations. These operations are secret to keep them from us and to preclude our deciding what we want our foreign policy to be. And so it becomes moot who you vote for anymore, because the presidents are still going to go on using the secret instrument. And that's why I think the issue of covert operations of the CIA is critical.
Well, Alan, it's not just the names of agents which can't be talked about anymore. It's any of the activities of any of the intelligence services, and that includes the FBI or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tax, and Firearms. That means that you wouldn't be able to make your documentary on company business now, right?
Right. It would be extremely difficult to make. But it also means that, for instance, if there are documented incidents, if you have someone in your group who proposes to you a terrorist incident and is actually working for the FBI or the CIA, and this has happened in the past, that you are not even allowed to name, to denounce him at a press conference that so-and-so has suggested we blow up an oil refinery, etc., and that we know that this man is working for the CIA, they could actually throw you in jail for 5 years
for revealing that.
Yeah. In other words, so you have no form at all of protection. And it's like creating the legal basis for the creation of an enormously powerful secret police force inside for use in this country. And that's exactly why, you know, I think the Watergate investigation occurred, because, as I said, one, in this case, Richard Nixon made a big mistake, and that was to have used the CIA or elements connected with the CIA inside this country and
against the other major party,
and the other major party was not about to just roll over and die.
Well, there are some people who say that it was the CIA who was very instrumental in bringing down Richard Nixon.
They
leaked information about the tapes, for instance.
Yeah, but you have to understand that there are people who understand that the destruction of the CIA would be when it gets politicized. Mm-hmm. In other words, if it becomes an instrument where whatever party is in power appoints a political appointee so they can protect themselves from destabilization efforts, then it's going to ruin it as an agency. Because you see, an intelligence agency, and there are American presidents and even CIA directors who are concerned about accurate information. I'll give you an example, which is a very dramatic one. One of the people interviewed in the film is Jesse Leaf, who is the former CIA chief analyst on Iran. His job, among other things, was to take all the intelligence they had from every source, in other words, from their satellite surveillance, from their telephone taps and telecommunications surveillance, from their agents, from in the army, the secret police, whatever, and project. First of all, describe what was happening in Iran in every sector of the society, and then project what the trends would be over a certain period of time. And these reports are prepared, and everything is documented. It's like doing a thesis. You refer to where you get all the information. He concluded in 1971 or 72 that the whole thing was going to blow up, that the Shah, the level of corruption was extraordinary, the Shah was antagonizing everybody, everybody was going to unite against him. He prepared this report, and this is on the basis of his honest appraisal, submitted it to the agency. The head of the Iran desk the next day called him in and said, this is unacceptable. He asked why it was unacceptable. He was told it's unacceptable because it's just unacceptable. Well, what he discovered was that this man who had, worked as a consultant to the Shah, number one. Number two, there were major American economic interests that were at stake, and they didn't care what happened in Iran as long as they made $300 million a year profits. If they could get five more years like that, the whole thing could go to hell at the end of the period of time, and they wouldn't give a damn. So that's what he was fighting about. This was a single individual. You know, this is like an American movie. It's like a Gary Cooper movie. This lone guy, not a gunslinger, walking down the street, representing honesty, etc., and he runs up against this whole structure, which is saying, no, no, we don't care what happens. And in the film, he tells you that he knew that the Savak was torturing people. His boss went to Iran and spent 5 years organizing the Savak. He had all kinds of reports about this, that the CIA was running Iran, that the Shah of Iran was a CIA agent. In other words, this man is the emperor of emperors, the emperor, the Persian king of kings, tracing himself back to Darius and Xerxes. And yet, the CIA chief of station would call him up, and he would volunteer information on what was happening in the royal palace. And so what they see is they see the embassy taken over. And Americans say, my God, these people are ungrateful. We've been channeling all this money. And they don't even know that rather than channeling all this money, they have been bleeding the country dry. They've been running the country. Everyone in Iran knows it. And so the anger comes out of that. And you look at the American media coverage of Iran and compare it with the European media coverage, that's incredible. I know of cases, for instance, where the Iranians made available Savak agents to the press. They could interview them, who were trained in the United States in the International Police Academy. I even know of a case of one man who, when he was trained here, invented a torture instrument, which is a pretty frightening thing, because what it is, it's like a hair dryer, this old woman's hair dryers. And what they would do is they would put it over your head, over your ears, and they would torture you in your own screams. It was designed so it was acoustically such that your own screams would actually reverberate in your ears. And, of course, you might say, well, this man might have been planted. The Iranians are making propaganda. But at least someone should have gone and talked to them.
And checked it out.
Nobody did.
That was U.S. filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS. You remember those old VHS videos? Their old VHS news service. And they would do interviews, and you could subscribe to it, and they would post you the old VHS videos in the post. That was back in the day. And he was interviewed by the video magazine, Alternative Views, way back in 1982. And we'll be having more from Alan Frankovich in future weeks. Next time, I think he's talking about Vietnam. That was a fascinating bit of history there about the American CIA's operations in Iran. And I think with those kind of things going on, who can blame the Iranians for wanting a revolution? Anyway, time, talking of revolutions, to talk to Jason Yannakopoulos now. Jason, what have you got for us this week then?
Well, I've got this. I've got this interesting article written by Nick Summerlad for in about April last year, talking about the Tetra incapacity benefit.
Is this like the ATOS test? And now he is a Summerlad is. I don't know if he's still at the Mirror, but he certainly was one of the Mirror's two investigative journalists. So they actually do make an effort to go out and find stories, which a lot of the newspapers don't do. You know,
this one is particularly sickening, I think is the word. It's 32 die a week after failing the test for the new incapacity benefit. This is
32 people a week dying.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, that how many? Hang on, how many? 365, 32. That's something like 10,000 a year, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, between January and August 2011, 1,100 claimants died after they were put in the work-related activity group. This group accounted for 21% of all claimants at the last count back last April.
Now, I suppose the question has to be, how does that compare to the normal rate? Because people die, don't they? You know, anyway. But I mean, you know, I think what they're implying there is that they're more likely to die more quickly if they're under loads of stress because they're about to have their benefits taken away. So just flesh that out a bit. What is he saying about the whole situation for disabled people?
Well, he's saying that it's getting. He's saying that it's getting ridiculously worse. I mean. It's got here a quote from Chris Grayling, the employment minister.
Oh, he was, wasn't he? Now he's in charge. In fact, he's the chairman of the Tory party.
Yeah. Well, at the point he was employment minister, said that that figure emphasises what a complete waste of human lives the previous system had been.
Which, how does he justify that? Or doesn't he?
He doesn't really.
Oh, no, Jason. This is a very disappointing performance for our so-called leaders. Okay. Any more in that article?
Well, it says. On top of the 1,100 that died after being put in the work-related activity group, a further 5,300 died after being put in the support group, which accounts for 22% of all claimants. And this group was at most unwell, and they got the full no-strings benefit of up to £99.85 a week to live on.
Well, we've had news this week, haven't we, of one particular disabled person in Bristol who was, I believe, he was told by ATOS. I know he was told by ATOS, who were doing the assessment, that because he could read the phone number on the letter that they'd sent him, which someone else actually helped him with, that he could read the rest of the letter and they wouldn't then send him something in larger print. And he's now won his case against them, and I think he's got a compensation of about £1,000. But the thing is, of course, if you're going to, as a disabled person, fight any of these decisions made by ATOS and the Department of Work and Pensions at the moment, it seems like you need a lawyer. I mean, how easy is it for disabled people to access lawyers, Jason?
It's not amazingly simple. I mean, this particular article doesn't actually go into that, but I know from having spoken to a friend that lawyers are or can be particularly expensive, and for somebody on benefits, it's very difficult to get a very good lawyer.
Yeah, the other thing is, of course, legal aid is being pulled away from a lot of these lawyers.
That's right.
The thing to do, though, is always to go and see your local law centre. We've got a couple of particularly good ones in Bristol. There's the Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the bottom of Stokes Croft. And there's another one, I can't actually remember what it's called, but anyway, they're on Old Market, so there are a few around. Pop in and talk to the lawyers there if you think that you know you think that what the government or ATOS are doing to you with your benefit claim is unfair in some way. It may even be illegal.
Yeah, it's interesting because the government claims that over half of new claimants for the incapacity benefit found fit to work, forgetting to mention that over 300,000 have appealed the decision and nearly half of them have won. So if you're wondering,
well, I mean, one of the cases I know personally very well, somebody who actually went in for an interview and then she got a copy of her interview back in the post, and there was only one or two of the things in that interview that she'd actually said in the interview. A lot of it had been actually made up, completely out of nowhere.
This
is the ATOS assessor. Now, the ATOS assessors are supposed to be doctors, but in this case, the doctor wasn't there, hadn't turned up or gone off somewhere else, and so the assessment had been done by a nurse who wasn't actually really qualified to do the assessment. So that's an appeal that I shall be reporting back on in future weeks, because the person concerned has appealed it.
Yeah, it's... You see, this is the problem. Is that there are a lot of claimants, and probably going to be more claimants, and this is the level that, for the sake of people, this is kind of the level we've come to expect, really. I mean, it's a shocking thing. I don't know if you may have watched a recent Panorama investigation into this with the issues at Triage, where there was a similar, albeit not identical, system. And you have the same people being referred to as LTVs, lying, thieving bastards.
Well, that's appalling, isn't it? And this is the... I suppose it's what is a kind of commercialisation of the... turning the what used to be public service into some sort of commercial operation where they're trying to deliver as little service as possible save money. They're actually incentivized to save money. Anyway, Jason, the other big story this week is, of course, the Pope.
Yes.
Was it a surprise to you, or did you have any inside knowledge?
No, it was not being the most religious person in the world, it was a complete surprise to me. It was I have to say that being as the Pope is supposed to be a job for life, I'm intrigued to find how exactly I was going to tender his resignation.
So you're pointing your two fingers together, Jason, pointing them at your head as if you're shooting yourself. So do you think that he should do that? Is that the right thing for the Pope to do? Is that because we do have precedents, don't we, back in medieval times for the Pope to resign?
We do. It's we do I think 1247 was the last case. It might have actually been 1457 was the last case. I can't remember which Pope that was.
1415, the same year as the Battle of Agincourt was the last time. And there was a previous time the Pope resigned because they were having a lot of trouble with a guy called Dante, if you remember him. He was writing a lot of stuff which was quite sort of satirical, but very much to the point, and also biblical. I mean, Dante's an interesting character. He was taking his stuff from the Bible and saying, you know, look, Pope, you fit quite a lot of these things the Bible's talking about here, so maybe you're the guy who's going to be burning in hell, not all the people you say are. So obviously Dante was causing a bit of problems for the medieval popes, and it was one called Boniface, one of the Boniface, which means pretty boy, I think, or pretty face or something, who took over. Anyway, I mean, we wish the Catholic Church well, I suppose, because it's an important institution, but let's just hope that they've got, you know, someone charge who's got the confidence of the congregation around the world. That's the thing. It's a massive, massive thing, the Catholic Church, isn't it? Right across South America, and an enormous institution.
I think it's time we had a non-European pope. I mean, there have been popes in the sort of Middle Ages from sort of Libyan place like that, but even then they were sort of like Roman Libyans, so they were still Romans. I mean, if you look at it would be intriguing to see sort of like a pope who's a black African or a Brazilian or that. It would certainly make a difference.
Do you think if you were Pope, Jason, you'd be like a Borgia or a Medici?
Well, being Greek Orthodox, I'm not entirely sure that I'm eligible for that office. But, you know.
I think you're, East rather than Western Church. Oh, dear, no, I don't think they could have you.
I'm more intrigued in seeing if Tony Blair is going to stand for Pope.
Oh, gosh. Well, that's an interesting... He's got to do something, hasn't he, to avoid jail, I think. He's got to take on some kind of role which is more to do with appearing to have a halo around his head. Now he's started a massive illegal war that's led to the deaths of millions of people in Iraq. Actually, what's going on in Iraq now is pretty horrific. You know, even every few days there are another series of bomb attacks and people are dying. I mean, what Mr. Blair and his friends have done to that country is appalling.
And it's not actually reported in most media at the moment.
it's a sort of reporting fatigue, isn't it? Because there's so many bomb attacks, they think, another bomb attack in Iraq, that's not news anymore.
You know, that's completely the wrong way to go about it, because we should be shocked by this, but we're not, because it's not getting reported. And, you know, the people who get these reports aren't shocked. They're like, it's just another bomb attack, and this is really the wrong way to look at it.
Okay, Jason, we'll speak to you next week.
Indeed. Thank you.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 15th of February, Marmalade Sky will be performing with support from Slim Shack at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 15th of February, the former Iron Maiden vocalist Blaze Bailey will be performing with support from Sinner God and Dead Man's Lane at the Green Bays in North Street, Weston-super-Mare. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Leonard Cohen. In a career that has spanned over 40 years, he has released 12 studio albums and 6 live albums. This is from his most recent album, Old Ideas, which was released in 2012, and is the song Crazy to Love You.
Had to go crazy to love you. Had to go down to the pit. Had to do time in the tower, begging my crazy to quit. Had to go crazy to love you. You who were never the one, whom I chased through the souvenir heartache, her braids and her blouse all undone. Sometimes I'd head for the highway. I'm old and the mirrors don't lie, but crazy has places to hide in that are deeper than any goodbye. Had to go crazy to love you. Had to let everything fall. Had to be people I hated. Had to be no one at all. I'm tired of choosing desire. I've been saved by a blessed fatigue. The gates of commitment unwired. Nobody trying to leave. Sometimes I'd head for the highway. I'm old and the mirrors don't lie, but crazy has places to hide in that are deeper than any goodbye. Had to go crazy to love you. You were never the one, whom I chased through the souvenir heartache, her braids and her blouse.
Leonard Cohen with Crazy to Love You from his most recent album Old Ideas. For more information, you can check out www.leonardcohen.com. Into Saturday, 16th of February, Boots and All, Filthy Rich and the Cat Flaps, The Self-Inflicted, What's the Point, Trigger Muck Poop Shoot, Broken Jaw, Brassic, The System Kills, 51st State and Cider Riot will all be performing at Cupid Stunts for the Love of Punk at the Green Bays in North Street, Weston-super-Mare. Tickets are £3.50 in advance from the venue and £5 on the door, and doors open at 4 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 17th of February, Harry Swan, The Chorus Envelope, Hayes Sleeper, Jack Simmons, and many more acts will all be performing at the 20-act all-dayer at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance, and doors open at 12:30 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, where they're also looking for actors and musicians. You'll find the Bristol Volunteer Bureau online at the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.